all these incidental regulations. But when you bear in mind that what is being set out is a way of living within the chosen community, then it makes a great deal of sense that the law should be spelt out in detail and applied in detail to all manner of issues. And these are best regarded as examples. It's as if the writer was saying, now, this has been said in the Ten Commandments. Here is the application of these commandments. For example, this, that, and the other. Now, we've already seen in chapter 21, and we see particularly once again here in chapter 22, one thing that stands out very, very clear is the requirement of restitution. If things go wrong, if trespass has been made, if injury has been done to our neighbor, then restitution has to take place. And this reminds us, you see, that there are two aspects of law involved here, and two issues involved. On the one hand, the law has been violated, and justice requires that the penalty of the law be visited on the guilty party. But in addition to that, injury has also been done to a neighbor. And in order that justice be fully done and be seen to be done, that injury must be repaired and restitution made. And this is one of the sections of the Old Testament which makes it clear that in many ways it was greatly in advance of its time. And indeed, as we pointed out last week, it's only recently that the whole concept of restitution at law has begun to be a factor in our present day legislation. So here is what happens when theft takes place, when damage is done through trespassing on another's property, verse 5, and also verse 6, if a fire break out, and so on, restitution has to be made. The law of trust or deposits in verse 7, if a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it be stolen, and so on. And the importance, that the important thing that's being stressed in this matter, in verses 7 to 13, is the sanctity of trust and the stewardship that can be committed to people. For example, and we can spiritualize this very truly. God commits a stewardship to his people. And we have, by derivation, responsibilities in the things that are committed to us. God has committed our souls to us, in a sense. And we have a stewardship to exercise in relation to our souls. God has committed our families to us. And we have a stewardship to exercise with our families. God has committed gifts to us, our time, our talents, and our resources. And we have to exercise a faithful stewardship in all these things, because these are things that we will be required to answer for in the sight of God, for all manner of trespass. Now, it's interesting to see in these verses, from verse 9 onwards, verse 10, if a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass, or an ox, or a sheep, or any beast to keep, and it die, or be hurt, or driven away, no man seeing it, then shall an oath of the Lord be between them both, that he hath not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. That is to say, when a man swears and takes an oath in the name of God that he is innocent of any transgression, then this should be enough to settle the matter. In verse 9, for example, however, or all manner of trespass, ox, ass, sheep, raiment, or any manner of lost thing, which another challengeth to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges. And whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. So that you see, there is a system of law and legal enactment within the community of Israel, even thus early. And the judges will have the say and will adjudicate in the matter. And the judge's word in this will be final. Now, not to spend too much time on that, the central message of these verses being the reality of restitution. Things have to be restored and restitution has to be made. Now, read on a bit further, verse 16. If a man entice a maid that is not betrothed and lie with her, he shall surely endow her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuse to give her unto him, he shall pay money according to the dowry of virgins. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Whosoever lieth with a beast shall surely be put to death. He that sacrificeth unto any god, save unto the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger, nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as a usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. Don't charge him interest. And I think the implication there is at an exorbitant rate. If thou at all take thy neighbor's raiment to pledge, thou shalt deliver it unto him by the time the sun goeth down. For that is his covering only. It is his raiment for his skin. Wherein shall he sleep? And it shall come to pass, when he crieth unto me, that I will hear. For I am gracious. Thou shalt not revile the gods. Some marginal readings have the judges. Others read it as a capital God. Thou shalt not revile God, nor curse the ruler of thy people. Thou shalt not delay to offer the first of thy ripe fruits and of thy liquors. The firstborn of thy son shalt thou give unto me. Likewise shalt thou do with thine oxen and with thy sheep. 7 days it shall be with his dam. On the 8th day thou shalt give it me. And ye shall be holy men unto me. Neither shall ye eat any flesh that is torn of beasts in the field. Ye shall cast it unto the dogs. Now, these are miscellaneous laws and enactments. But I think the important thing for us to recognize here and to see clearly here is the reference in at the end of verse 27. All these things are being said by the Lord. For I am gracious. You see, it's the grace and the compassion of the Lord that runs right through these enactments. And it's really very wonderful to see this, the gentleness and the tenderness of the Holy God towards those who might tend to be wronged in society. They are the objects of God's care and concern. And this is one of the great lessons that we can learn in the Old Testament scriptures. People, and I've often pointed this out, seem often to dismiss the Old Testament scriptures as harsh and relentless. But you see here, I am gracious, says the Lord. Take, for example, this incident in verse 16. If a man entice a maid that is not betrothed and lie with her, he shall surely endow her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuse to give her unto him, he shall pay money according to the dowry of virgins. When you think of the censorious attitude of the Pharisees towards the woman taken in adultery in our Lord's time, in contrast with Jesus' very gentle and tender dealing with her, you find that Christ's attitude in John chapter 8 and this attitude here breathe the same spirit of gentleness and tenderness. Those who are wronged are the care and compassion of God. Now, it does seem clear that in verse 16, that this act is regarded by the Lord virtually as marriage. And that being so, the man is not allowed to contract out of his responsibility in this matter. And whether or not marriage is unsuitable or undesirable in this case is something decided not by the man who has wronged the girl, but by her father. The man himself has forfeited his right to pronounce on the suitability of the match. He must think now in terms of responsibility, not suitability. And he is responsible to God, who cares for the defenseless girl and is her protector. Isn't that a beautiful picture? We have only to look around ourselves, our society today, to see how often heartlessness and the attitude of don't want to know tends to prevail in such a situation. But in olden time, God laid it on the line that such things would be his concern. And he would be her vindicator, and those who wronged her would have to answer to him. And that spirit of tenderness seems to stand in marked contrast to the next verse. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And this seems to be a very harsh enactment. But I think we have to understand this in the light of the teaching of the scriptures in general. And two considerations especially. One is this, that all trafficking with evil spirits is forbidden upon the strictest penalties. And what we have to recognize is that the biblical opposition to spiritualism and spiritist things is not that it is false, because it's not false. It's because it is wrong. Look across to Deuteronomy chapter 18 and see what is said in verse 9 onwards. Deuteronomy 18 at verse 9. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not learn to do after the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord. And because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. That's the biblical position. If it were simply a case of spiritism being false, the attitude of God would be one of pity and compassion, lamenting the ignorance of people. But that's not the attitude that's expressed in the scriptures, for the reason that it is not the falsity of the matter, but the wrongness and the evil of the matter. This is why it's such a perverse thing that most of our national dailies, and sadly enough, our own national paper in Scotland now, has its horoscope page. How sad. How are the mighty fallen? This is the real issue. These things are wrong, and they are evil, and the people of God have to give them a wide berth. That's the thing. The other consideration is this. what we said earlier last week, remember, about the death penalty for crimes other than murder, can be said to apply here also. It was essential for the very existence of this new people of God that they should be kept pure from the influences that God had condemned in the surrounding nations. The whole point of the judgment of these heathen nations in Canaan was that the cup of their iniquity had been filled up. They'd become so depraved that the only thing that could be done with them was destruction. And God said, don't associate with anything of that nature. And that's why this very strict enactment is made. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. As we said last time, the death penalty has long since been removed from crimes other than murder, and indeed also from murder now in these days. But in the old days, in the 18th century, men were hanged for stealing sheep. One does not do that now. But it's still wrong to steal sheep. And we have to observe the distinction between the sanction of the law and any particular penalty that is imposed upon it. The same applies to verse 19. Whosoever lieth with a beast shall surely be put to death. And for the same reason, the unnaturalness of this sin. He that sacrificeth unto any god, save unto the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. And then the wonderfully gentle and tender attitude once more, verse 21. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him. For ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Now, the case of the stranger is one that has a great deal of relevance today and is of practical application in all sorts of situations, whether in society in general or in the life of a congregation. We know only too well that there's a great deal of racial discrimination around us. It's not so very long ago, a year or two ago, when we were appalled to learn that there were landladies in Edinburgh who gave board and lodging to overseas students. And some of them who came here told us stories that were just appalling in the discrimination, the contempt with which they were treated because they were from overseas. Now, that happens in our society, and there can be no questioning the truth of it. Hopefully, such a situation should be brought under public scrutiny and condemned, but it happens in our society. But the fact is that strangers often have very few rights, and they're always in danger of being imposed upon, and they become an easy prey. A stranger may come into our church. They may have heard that God is among us, and they are drawn by that knowledge, and they come seeking God, and they sit down in church, and they receive a chilling welcome, or lack of it. They get a cold shoulder. People are not interested in them, and they go out. And they wonder whether they've made a great mistake. God cannot be there for people to treat me like that. See how it works? Thou shalt not vex a stranger, nor oppress him. And notice the reason that is given for this. For thou wast a stranger in the land of Egypt. Now, I want you to look with me at one or two references in the book of Deuteronomy on this theme. Deuteronomy 14, at the end of the chapter, verse 28, at the end of 3 years thou shalt bring forth all the tithe of thine increase the same year, and shalt lay it up within thy gates. And the Levite, because he hath no part nor inheritance with thee, and the stranger, and the fatherless, and the widow, who are within thy gates shall come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hand which thou doest. The next chapter, chapter 15, at verse 7. If there be among you a poor man of one of thy brethren within any of thy gates in thy land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart, nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother, but thou shalt open thy hand wide unto him, and shalt surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wanteth. And then in the next chapter, chapter 16, at verse 11, thou shalt rejoice before the Lord thy God, thou and thy son and thy daughter, thy manservant and thy maidservant, and the Levite that is within thy gates, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow that are among you, in the place which the Lord thy God hath chosen to place his name there. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and thou shalt observe and do these statutes. Verse 14, thou shalt rejoice in thy feast, thou and thy son and thy daughter and thy manservant and thy maidservant and the Levite and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow that are within thy gates. Thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt. And you know, if we really can remember what it used to be like with us before the good Lord laid his hand upon us and found us and brought us to himself, if we really remember the anguish, the loneliness, the isolation, the alienation, the sheer unhappiness of being outside of Christ, then we are bound to have compassion for the poor, the widow, the fatherless, the stranger. That's what is being said here. We remember that we were bondmen in Egypt. And if we remember that we were strangers in the land of Egypt, our hearts will just go out and we will feel for them. We will not necessarily say to them, I know what you feel because I was once like that, but that will be the motivating power in our desire to make them feel at home. Have you ever been lonely? Have you ever been in the position in which you have cried from your heart and said, no man cared for my soul? Then if you've been there, you'll know exactly what people who are in need and outside of Christ may be feeling like. And surely your heart will go out to them in the compassion of the Savior, and you'll feel for them, and you'll want to have consideration for them. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear them, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Isn't it extraordinary what a strength of feeling there is in the heart of God for the oppressed, for the poor and the needy? This is really what expressed in that lovely Advent hymn that we sang tonight. He comes, the prisoners to relieve in Satan's bondage held. He comes from darkening scales of light to clear the inward sight, and on the eyeballs of the blind to pour celestial light. He comes, the broken hearts to bind, the bleeding souls to cure, and with the treasures of his grace to enrich the humble poor. That's what Christmas is supposed to be about. And here we have it in the book of Exodus. And don't you see, with this kind of spirit in the heart of God, it was surely inevitable that such a spirit should want to come down into a world full of that kind of need to help and to bless and to heal. That was the motivating power behind the incarnation, the boundless compassion of God. That's what we have in these almost incidental enactments. And the same goes for verse 25. If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as a usurer, a money lender, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. And it simply means this. God's people should have special consideration by God's people. It's as simple as that. Our brother. It's interesting that they don't, the scriptures don't forbid legitimate lending at rates of interest. And that's not what's in view here, because elsewhere in the scriptures that is made perfectly clear. There's always the barrier against exorbitant interest. It's not commercial considerations, but compassionate considerations that are in view. But with the brother, this is the special treatment. If thou at all take thy neighbor's raiment to pledge, thou shalt deliver it unto him by the time the sun goeth down. For that is his covering only. He has nothing else to cover him in the cold of the night. It is his raiment. Wherein shall he sleep? And it shall come to pass when he crieth unto me that I will hear, for I am gracious. And also in verse 29, thou shalt not delay to offer the first of thy ripe fruits and of thy liquors. The firstborn of thy sons shalt thou give unto me. Likewise shalt thou do with thine oxen and with thy sheep. 7 days it shall be with his dam. On the eighth day thou shalt give it unto me. Then in the next chapter, we must go on a little bit here before the time goes. Something of a rather different nature. Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Then in the Authorized, this is a very difficult phrase, and I've got an alternative translation. Neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment. That doesn't help us very much. And the NIV reads as follows. Verse 2, do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. When you give testimony in a lawsuit, do not pervert justice by siding with the crowd. And do not show favoritism to a poor man in his lawsuit. Now, I think the word lawsuit here is a key to an understanding. Verse 1 is not speaking of general false reports and spreading untruths about people. It has to do with the judicial system. And the emphasis here is on what happens in law courts. And witnesses who are brought to court are not to raise false reports. There is such a thing as perjury, and we may not tell lies. This is the point of the oath in court. I promise before God to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And this is underlined here. Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. And verse 2 seems to apply to the judges in the court. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. When you give testimony in a lawsuit, do not pervert justice by siding with the crowd, and do not show favoritism to a poor man in his lawsuit. Verse 3. The note here, you see, is impartiality. And this is very applicable in a court of law. One is only to think, for example, of the attitude of Pontius Pilate at the trial of Jesus. He followed the crowd. He knew what he should have done. He knew what was the right thing to do. He knew perfectly well that Jesus was not guilty of the charges brought against him. But then he also had other considerations in his mind. He knew that if he went against the crowd, they might provide an adverse report to the Roman authorities, and his career might be in jeopardy. And therefore he followed the crowd and did evil. And this is what is forbidden here. Do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. And when you give testimony in a lawsuit, do not pervert justice by siding with the crowd. On the other hand, do not countenance a poor man in his cause. Do not show favoritism to a poor man just because he's poor. Now that's an important consideration, because the poor man may be in the wrong. And justice has to be impartial on both sides. And neither witness nor judge must allow himself to be influenced away from the truth, so as to cause any miscarriage of justice. And witnesses are warned against either inventing or circulating an untrue report, either by word or by gesture or by silence, because there are lots of ways of conveying a false impression. And we must remember that in our dealings in personal relationships. I have known people who, without saying a word, have conveyed a false impression. I remember a Christian man passing judgment on a friend of mine who was a minister. And he did so very effectually, practically, without saying a word. The man, the minister's name was mentioned. This man said, "Ah." And the way he said that, "Ah," spoke volumes. And everybody in the place got the impression that this minister had something wrong. "Ah." The deprecating, "Ah, that's all you need to say." And it will not do for such a man to say, but I never said anything. You sometimes do not even have to say, ah, to convey the false report. And that's what is warned against here. If thou meet thine enemy's ox or his ass going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If thou see the ass of him that hateth thee lying under his burden, and wouldst forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help with him. Now here once again, you see, is the fairness and the compassion of God. And God is saying, now it's not on for one of my people to say in such a situation, why should I go out of my way to help him? He doesn't like me. He hates me. Why should I? God says, now that's not on. Rise above that attitude. Be bigger than that. If thou see the ass of him that hateth thee lying under his burden and wouldst forbear to help him, and that would be the temptation, you see. God says, resist that temptation and extend the helping hand. Thou shalt not rest the judgment of thy poor in his cause. The RSV says, do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits. Have nothing to do with a false charge, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. And in verse 8, thou shalt take no gift. Now, I'm glad to tell you that that has nothing to do with the receiving of Christmas presents. So you can still have your Christmas presents. What it refers to, of course, is bribe. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the righteous. Also, thou shalt not oppress a stranger, for ye know the heart of a stranger, seeing ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Do you remember that parable Jesus told about the two debtors? The man who owed a great sum, and when he had nothing to pay, his master freely forgave him. And then there was that other servant who owed this man a small sum, and he was merciless. And he put the pressure on him and earned the righteous condemnation of the Lord. Now you see, this is what lies behind this verse. Ye know the heart of a stranger, seeing ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. See, everything comes back to our experience of redemption. If we've really experienced the wonder of his redeeming love, it makes us a certain kind of person who is incapable of being merciless, who will remember what a stranger feels like, because we were once strangers. Do you not feel that this is a very moving challenge and a moving exhortation? Ye once were strangers in the land of Egypt. And then these last two or three verses before we close. 6 years shalt thou sow thy land, and shalt gather in the fruits thereof, but the seventh year thou shalt let it rest and lie still, that the poor of thy people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field shall eat. In like manner thou shalt deal with thy vineyard and with thy oliveyard. 6 days thou shalt do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest, that thine ox, thine ass may rest, and the son of thine handmaid, and the stranger may be refreshed. And in all things that I have said unto you, be circumspect. Make no mention of the name of other gods, neither let it be heard out of thy mouth. Now, this has to do with, this is an application of the commandment about the Sabbath day. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Since the Sabbath belongs to the order of creation, Genesis chapter 2, we cannot really regard it as a mere Jewish ceremonial ordinance to be abrogated and neglected or despised with impunity. And it's not without significance, surely, that our age, which has seen the most widespread neglect and secularization of the Lord's Day, has become known as the age of anxiety, with something like 60% of all hospital beds in Britain occupied by patients with psychological rather than physical disorder and disease. My brother, in his notes on this passage, quotes a story told of native carriers in Africa who would go so far in one day's journey and then refuse to go another inch. They said they had to stop to let their spirits catch up with them. Now, doesn't that say a very great deal about our frantic age? To stop to let our spirits catch up with us. That's what our society needs today. Not Sunday opening. Least of all, to celebrate the birth of the Saviour. What an obscenity that is. Sunday opening. Sunday opening. And far worse in Scotland than in England now. Far worse. That's the tragedy and the sorrow and the shame for a land that used to be called the land of the book. Well, there can be no doubt at all that it will do despite to the truest well-being of our land and our people. Think of this African quote as we close. They said they had to stop to let their spirits catch up with them. Well, there's a lot of catching up to be done, isn't there, in our day? That's why we need to preserve the Lord's name. Not in a spirit of legalism. Not in a frowning spirit. But in the realization that something infinitely precious is being lost to our land and to our people. 6 days thou shalt do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest. And even the land needs to rest. We have to stop to let our spirits catch up with us. That's a good way to look on a Sunday, isn't it? We're stopping to let our spirits catch up with us, to get properly orientated once again. It's very wonderful to see all this in these, at first glance, rather improbable and insignificant enactments. They all breathe a certain spirit. And remember in verse 27 of chapter 22, all this is to be done, for I am gracious. This is our God. Let us pray.